Thank you all very much for coming for this first, I guess, or semi-first session of the Cannes Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation Conference. Delighted to have so many of you come out on this beautiful evening. As I've been telling all our out-of-town guests, the weather is like this 300 days a year here. So if you're looking for a summer house or something, this is the place to come. Talking to the mic, is that better? I'm rarely told I don't talk loud enough. That's a first. I want to thank a bunch of people for helping make this conference possible. This conference, first of all, is being sponsored by and created by a group called the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research, IMPR as it's called, which is a group that's been formed in the past couple years to try to encourage media scholarship on policy issues about the structure and nature of our media system, and link this research with activists, with policymakers, with citizens groups, so that we can have better media policies and a superior media system. And IMPR has been graciously funded by a number of sources, not the least of which is the University of Illinois. And also it's been supported by the Stewart Family Foundation, the Joyce Foundation. And I want to say a special word to Irving Azoff, who's been one of our supporters. Irving is not here tonight for a medical reason, a health reason, nothing too serious, but he would have been here. His generosity made IMPR possible. Without Irving Azoff, we wouldn't be here tonight. In addition, on campus, to help this conference take place, a few groups I want to say thank you to: my home college, the College of Communications and the Institute of Communications Research, the Center for Global Studies, the College of Law, the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, the Department of Journalism, the Department of Political Science, the Department of Sociology, Department of Speech Communication, and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Each of these groups came together to help support this event, showing, I think, a lot of the camaraderie that exists on this campus, and I want to thank all of them for their help with this endeavor. Now, this group, IMPR, that I helped start, the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research, I hope you're going to hear a lot more about it in the years to come. There are very few universities, I think, where it would be possible to do something like IMPR. In fact, I'm pretty certain from my experience, I can't think of many other at all. It's unconventional, it's risky, it's the sort of thing most administrators say, well, we'll let someone else do that one, we'll look the other way. We're very fortunate that this university has embraced IMPR, has embraced this conference and the work we are doing in a manner that, frankly, my friends outside of this community can't believe. They say, how do you pull that off? There are many people to thank for this, and lots of hard work in years past has paved the way for this to take place. But one person gets the most credit. One person had the power to say yes to IMPR and yes to this conference, or no to IMPR and no to this conference, and that person is Chancellor Richard Herman, here sitting up there on the dais. His support has been foundational. His commitment to making the UIUC a center for public engagement on core issues of our times is a genuine commitment. He's backing it up. I'm in his debt. We all are. So please join me in welcoming Chancellor Richard Herman.
Thank you, Bob. Please excuse my voice, just getting over a cold. You know, one of the things I can say about working with Bob is he always presents ideas that glow in the dark, so it's been a pleasure to take, and I think taking risk is what universities need to be about. He was also clever enough to have Irving give me a call as well. Well, thank you all for joining us this evening. As some of you may know, I am a mathematician by training, and this may be the first time you've ever seen a mathematician give a talk facing forward. But I do remember learning in middle school that good reporters always need to cover the five W's in their stories. Well, there's also the H, or how. It seems to me that element is what this conference is looking at. How do we survive in an era of unprecedented media consolidation when pressures on the bottom line too often dictate the quality of journalism being done? As I thought about this conference, I began to see how your choices of who, what, when, where, and why ensure that this event would be both informative and compelling. A quick perusal of the named panelists clearly indicates that this is going to be a thought-provoking few days. You've chosen your speakers, or should I say your who, quite well. Your topic for consideration, Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation, is perhaps the most important challenge the media will face in our lifetime. You've chosen your topic, your what, carefully as well. Just yesterday, a story in the Chicago Tribune described how a conservative group prevented the release of an episode of PBS's Postcards for Buster because Buster Baxter, the cartoon rabbit in the show, visited a real-life family with lesbian moms. A discussion of fairness and balance couldn't be more appropriate or timely. Of all institutions in a free society, universities are best positioned to be at the forefront of difficult issues. You are in the right place, the right where, for this conversation. But why hold this discussion at all? At this media policy research conference, we gather our humanitarians and pair them with other esteemed scholars and leaders of the media to ask the question, can freedom of the press survive media consolidation? Is the question critical? Is it timely? You bet. A free and independent press is critical to the Jeffersonian democracy, perhaps more so now than it was in Jefferson's own time. Americans must be well informed to fully realize the responsibilities of their citizenship. Yet we live at a time when media outlets are becoming more partisan, owned by corporations, more heavily invested in national politics. Today it seems that fairness and balance are relative. The news on Fox bears little resemblance to the same news events covered in the New York Times. Today, too many people view their choice on what news and talk they consume as an either-or proposition. Either I'll hear a conservative slant or I'll hear a liberal slant. Are we trading America's racially segregated past for a new kind of American segregation? The role of the Academy is to apply its research capabilities to these questions. We bring a scholarly approach, combining quantitative research with qualitative analysis, while bringing great minds together who can help us understand these issues, the first step to finding solutions. The presence of these esteemed panelists will serve to inspire our students as well, students who will become the next generation of defenders of media independence. I might also mention that we hope to inspire our May graduates coming up this weekend by awarding honorary doctorate degrees to the Chicago Tribune's Hanky Gretto, CBS News commentator Bill Geist, and Judith Krug, the executive director of the Freedom to Read Foundation and a leading defender of free press. And our institutional responsibility to contribute to the formation of important public policy was the reason we formed the Illinois Initiative on Media Policy Studies. The initiative and this conference are indications of this university's commitment to the study of our culture, the study of subjects that affect our daily lives, our civic participation, and ultimately, how our society develops in the 21st century and beyond. So I'd like to close with the words of journalist Walter Lippmann, who addressed the International Press Institute almost exactly 40 years ago today. I imagine everyone in the audience, or most of you, know this by heart. A free press is not a privilege, but an organic necessity in a great society. Without criticism and reliable and intelligent reporting, the government cannot govern. That is why. And why is, of course, the most important W of all. Have a great conference.
Thank you again, Chancellor Herman. I hope you've all got your little orange book. Good. I'll be giving a test on it tomorrow afternoon, so better study it. What you'll notice, fortunately, is that two of our panelists tonight, Naomi Klein and Amy Goodman, will be on sessions tomorrow, as will Seymour Hersh, who spoke earlier. I know a lot of you saw him speak from 5 to 6:30. In tomorrow's sessions, there will be, we hope, long Q&A periods where you can rise up and ask questions of our panelists. Tonight, unfortunately, I don't think we're going to have time for Q&A in here. It's not set up for that. We're going to just let our three speakers have an opportunity to speak. And the batting order will be first Representative Sanders, then Naomi Klein, then Amy Goodman. And we'll start with Bernie Sanders. And when we decided to do this conference on freedom of the press and media consolidation, I wanted to have one person from Congress who deals with these issues at a policy level, who's concerned about them, to speak to us, to come before us, to give that perspective, their concerns. And this was the easiest decision I had to make when thinking about people to invite. There are a lot of excellent members of Congress, including in our Illinois delegation, on these issues, who are very concerned about these issues. But there's no one that's Bernie Sanders' equal in the knowledge of media issues, media policy issues, and in his commitment to establishing a free press. I've had the privilege of coming to know Bernie Sanders we've been in the U.S. House since 1991. This is your eighth term. I've known you for many of those years and have gotten to talk to you, especially about media issues. And what was striking to me in dealing with Representative Sanders was that he really got the importance of media, just as the quote that Chancellor Herman gave from Lippmann. That's in Bernie Sanders' DNA. That's in his bone marrow. That's not something you have to tell him that. He understands that immediately. He understands immediately that if we don't have a free press, all the issues he cares about, and that all of us care about, whatever they are, can't get the hearing necessary to have a democratic and peaceful resolution. And coming to know Mr. Sanders over the years, I found him a man of unusual intelligence and integrity and really great political shrewdness. One of the striking things Bernie Sanders did, and one of the reasons he's here, is that long before anyone else, he decided that there was a lot of popular interest in media issues. Now, I'm going to take you back just a few years, 2002, 2001, back then, which now seems in the realm of media activism like ancient history, like we're talking about the War of the Roses. Back then, it was generally thought that people didn't care about media politics, media policies, ownership, public broadcasting, internet access, that these issues were really wonky, that no one cared about. Bernie Sanders said, no, I think people really do care about this. And he convened two town meetings in Vermont. Now, if you know Bernie Sanders, you know that he holds town meetings constantly. In fact, you just had a series on poverty, if I'm not mistaken, Bernie. They were a big hit. He held the first two town meetings on media ownership, corporate control of the media, and what the problems of that are for a democratic society. He held those 3 years ago, almost exactly to this date. John Nichols and I were able to attend them with Bernie, and the rooms were packed, literally hanging from the rafters, rooms this size. And, you know, Bernie, you do, what, 10, 20 of these a year? I mean, and this was ranked in your top two or three you'd ever had in terms of response. Just people cared about this issue. They had never been asked before. It was the first time, come talk, let us hear what you think. And we did as much listening as we did talking. But John Nichols and I left that, and I think Bernie left that. We knew there was something happening in this country that no one else had quite figured out. And that's really driven a lot of our work since then. Let me just give you one last story about Bernie Sanders, then I'm going to let him talk. But I think why he's such an important figure in media policy is that he has an acute mind that really sees strategically what can and can't be done and how to do it in a way that few politicians, from my experience, have, the ones I've gotten to know. And the story I'd like to close with is a few years ago, John Nichols and I, and John's here, he'll be speaking tomorrow, we went to Washington to meet with a number of members of Congress to talk about media policy issues. And there's a sort of a group we always would go see. Bernie was usually on the list. And we met with one member of the House of Representatives, who, a wonderful member, I'm not going to name him because he's a friend. And John and I had dinner with him. We went late into the night with him, into 1 or 2 a.m., because we talked about media and politics in general for 3 or 4 hours, and he was taking notes in his laptop, and he was really into it. I had said, yeah, this is great, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to do that. Nothing came of it. Nothing came of it. He's a great guy, but he's just, that's almost, I hate to say it, things you say, yeah, that sounds great, but then they let it drop. The next day, John Nichols and I were at a Senate hearing, so we're running late for our meeting with Bernie. And we were going to run over to meet Bernie at his office. But Bernie, at this point, this is Friday, is returning to Burlington, where he goes every weekend. And he was on his way to his car. He said, too late, guys. You can't meet with me. I'm too busy now. I've got to get home. I always go to Vermont every weekend. And so John and I said, well, can we walk with you to your car, Bernie? And just talk to you while you walk to your car. It's 2 blocks away. And he said, okay. And so we talked to Bernie for 5 or 6 minutes. And in that time, we agreed to do a hearing on public broadcasting in Burlington, Vermont, with Commissioner Copps. Bernie gave enough material so John Nichols had a story in The Nation. And we accomplished all the stuff in 5 minutes that most politicians couldn't accomplish in 5 hours. It was an extraordinary experience. I mean, just the steel trap mind we're talking about. As I said, Bernie Sanders has been in the House since 1990, representing the entire state of Vermont. As some of you may know, there's an open seat in the U.S. Senate in Vermont in 2006. There's a chance that Bernie Sanders may elect to run as an independent. And if he does, there's an excellent chance he could well become the next junior senator from the state of Vermont. So please join me in welcoming Bernie Sanders.
Thank you, Bob. The only problem with Bob's introduction is he gave page one, page two of my speech. I'm down to page five now. I want to congratulate Bob and Ben Scott and the University of Illinois and all of the people who have put on this conference and have said that media consolidation and what's happening with regard to corporate control over the media is a huge issue. If you are concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about women's rights, healthcare, foreign policy, Iraq, the economy, if you are concerned about any of those issues, you must be concerned about the media. And what people like Bob and John Nichols and others have been saying for years, which I fully agree with, is we have got to make corporate control over the media a political issue in the same way that healthcare and education in Iraq is a political issue. And that means that when somebody runs for office and comes before you and they talk about the issues, you raise your hand and say, what are you going to do about corporate control over the media? And after the candidate recovers, after his fall on the ground, he or she will start responding. But we have got to make it a political issue because it is as important or more important than any other issue that we talk about. Let me begin by telling you how I first recognized that media was a huge issue. Way back in the 1970s, before I became mayor of Burlington, Vermont, I did a little bit of independent writing. And I did a video, if you like, not quite a film, on the life of Eugene Victor Debs, who some of you know was one of the great labor and socialist heroes in America. And I did it because nobody in Vermont, none of the kids and kids in America today do not know who Debs was, as they do not know the names of many great American heroes. Well, we did the video, and it was not very sophisticated, but it was a fairly good video done for a few thousand dollars. And we took it to our local public television station. And we said, here's a video, and we'd like you to run it. And they looked at it, and 1 month went by, and 2 months went by, and 3 months went by, and then they finally wrote back, and they said, sorry, Mr. Sanders, we can't use your video because it doesn't tell both sides of the story. Because as you know, on all programming that you see on public television, you always hear the socialist and capitalist point of view, the progressive and conservative. That's the way it is. So they couldn't put it on. Well, that got me a little bit upset, and it turned out that in Vermont, there were other people who were not necessarily political, but they were local filmmakers, Vermont filmmakers, and they were unable to get their films on Vermont public television. The result of that is we started a little bit of a movement, and we put pressure on our local public television station. And the outcome of it was one of the great nights of my life that I will never forget. The University of Vermont, which owned the public television station, agreed to negotiate with us, and we worked out a town meeting of the air on prime time, 3 hours, prime time Vermont public television, to discuss what should public television in Vermont be. So we had about 15 people from the establishment who thought the status quo was good, and we brought 15 people who wanted change. And the guy who was moderating it opened up the phone lines. And this is the truth. So many phone calls came in that the phone line to that station in Winooski, Vermont actually broke down. So I got the clue that media was an important issue. And as Bob mentioned, I think our office held the very first town meeting on corporate control over the media a number of years ago. Jeff Cohn, who's one of the founders of FAIR, came to Vermont, and Bob McChesney and John Nichols have been up. We held a meeting with Michael Copps, who on media consolidation has been doing an outstanding job as a member of the FCC. We had 600 people coming out to St. Michael's College to discuss that issue. So anyone who tells you that media is not an important issue is missing the boat completely. It is enormously important, and the people of America want serious discussion and resolution on the issue. Now let me tell you why the perspective that I can bring in with a very distinguished panel is that of a politician, an elected official, who tries to use his office to educate and organize, as well as to pass legislation and do the things the members of Congress do. And let me tell you some of the concerns that I have with what's going on in the media today. Am I concerned that when I am asked to speak about an issue like Iraq, I get 6 seconds to respond? Yep, I'm concerned. Because I can't, and you can't, and our panelists can't, and nobody can discuss an issue intelligently in a 6-second soundbite, which is what dominates television, which is the most important medium in our country. Am I concerned that by definition, corporately owned media is pro-corporate? Yeah, I am very concerned about that. We see the manifestations of that all over the place. We saw the difference between how the corporate media treated a moderate Democrat like Bill Clinton as opposed to a conservative Republican like George Bush. We saw how they covered the lead-up and the war in Iraq so that millions of Americans, in order to get unbiased news, had to go to the CBC in Canada or the BBC. Am I concerned about that? I sure am. Am I concerned that the media seems to think that one of the major issues facing civilization today is the Michael Jackson case? Or maybe, break it to you, Britney Spears is pregnant. It's true. And we'll have many months of discussion about that, or the local trials, or the horrible crimes. Am I concerned about that? I sure am. But of all of those concerns and many more, let me tell you what my deeper concern is. My concern is not just what the media reports or discusses and the slants that it has on the issues. That's important. But the deeper concern is what the media does not talk about. And as an elected official, as a public official, this is of huge concern to me, and I will tell you why. If media does not reflect the reality of people's lives, does not talk to people in a way that they say, yeah, that's me, that's my experience. If media ignores the reality of people's lives, then people end up thinking, gee, I'm making $8 an hour. I can't afford to take care of my family. I must be the only person in America in that position. It's my fault. And I don't have any health insurance. I guess I must be lazy or irresponsible. It must be my fault. It's not a political issue. It's not a social issue. It's not a solvable issue. It's just my issue. So let me just talk about some of the issues that the media does not talk about. To my mind, the most significant non-discussed issue in American society is the collapse of the middle class. In the last 30 years, as everybody in this room knows, there has been an explosion in technology and worker productivity. That means that every one of you is today or will be in the future far more productive than people who held your job or a similar job 30 years ago. One might think that with that explosion of technology and worker productivity, that the average American would either be making more money by working the same number of hours, or in fact, making the same amount of money and working fewer hours. That's what one might think. The reality, of course, is that despite this huge increase in worker productivity, the middle class is shrinking. People are working longer hours for lower wages. Poverty is increasing. And the standard of living of millions of people is in decline. When I was a kid, the expectation was that one breadwinner in a family, in those days usually the male, one could work 40 hours a week and earn enough money to pay the bills. Today, you don't know any family, any middle-class family who's in that position. Husbands and wives, people are working incredible hours. In my state, it is not uncommon for people to work not one job, but two jobs, but three jobs to make enough income to get health care, to get the benefits that they need. That is the story of our time, and that is the story that the media does not talk about. What else? Now, one of the reasons that the middle class is shrinking is that we are seeing an unprecedented gap between the rich and the poor in America today. Richest 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 90%. CEOs of large corporations earn more than 500 times what their workers make. Wealthiest 17,000 families earn more income than the bottom 20 million American families. You have an economic issue, is that wealth is being created, but it's going to the people on top. Now you tell me how often you hear that issue on television or radio. That's about right. That's close to exactly right. It is a non-discussed issue. So in a world where we talk about family values and morality, forget economics here, how often are we posing the question of the appropriateness of seeing in this country a huge increase in billionaires while at the same time we have the highest rate of childhood poverty, 20%, in the industrialized world? Who is posing that moral question? Haven't heard Pat Robertson speaking about it lately. Everybody knows, even my colleagues in Congress, that our health care system is disintegrating. We all know that 35 million Americans have no health insurance, more uninsured. We pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. And yet, most Americans do not know that the United States of America is the only nation in the industrialized world that does not guarantee health care to all people as a right of citizenship. Have you seen the programming on television talking about that simple fact? Very often in Vermont, I go out and I talk to kids a lot. I love doing that. I go to almost every high school in the state. And I say to kids, tell me, how much does it cost? You know, kids are all struggling to figure out how they're going to afford to go to college. How much does it cost to go to college in Germany? And some kids say, I think it's free in Germany, which it is. How many Americans understand that higher education in Europe, Scandinavia, and even Canada is substantially lower, in some cases free? And why is that? And what does that have to do with Europe? You know, Europe has its share of serious problems. When you get pregnant in the United States, we fought very hard, and we are going to get you a 3-month family leave. Wow, you can't get fired. When you get pregnant. Isn't that something? How many Americans know that in European countries you get 6 months of 8 months with guaranteed payment, with 50, 75% of your paycheck coming in? So in this country, after you have a baby, yeah, you can't get fired by staying home, but if you don't have any money, you have to go to work anyhow. How many people know that? Do we talk about that? The United States today has a $618 billion trade deficit. Our entire trade policy is a gross failure. We have lost millions of decent-paying jobs, and we're about to hemorrhage millions of good-paying information technology jobs. What about? I had fun recently. Last month, I had the opportunity to testify before the Ways and Means Committee on trade. And when you ask people about the propriety of having American workers forced to compete against people who make 30 cents an hour and go to jail, as they do in China when they try to form a union, you know what? Nobody has a response. And yet every editorial page of every major newspaper in America has supported NAFTA and free trade with China. How often do we hear that discussion in the news? The president, whenever you see the president, he is always or very often in front of the military people. The background is the troops behind them, giving a speech, telling us how much he loves the troops. How often have you seen in the newspapers the fact that this president's budget has slashed, decimated health care for veterans in this country? Slashed it. So when people ask themselves, they say, why is it that working class people vote against their own economic interest, which many do? One of the reasons is that the economic reality facing the working class of this country is very rarely discussed. In fact, even the concept of working class, working people as a class, is not acknowledged. Question. Here it is. You ready? You're all very bright people here at the University of Illinois. Name me three leaders of the American working class. What is this guy talking about? What does that mean? There's nobody. What? What does that mean? You don't know anybody. There is nobody. You got tens of millions of people who are in the working class. You define it however you want to. People who are struggling to keep their heads above water. Who are the leaders? We don't know who the leaders are. We don't recognize working people as a class. So how do we go forward if we can't even define that? How many of you have seen on television, we have many, many, millions of workers, not enough, numbers are going down in trade unions. You tell me, and I want you to be honest, how many of you have ever seen a program on television discussing the role and the positive role that trade unionism has played in America in improving the lives of the American people? Anybody seen a program? Okay. So, to my mind, when I get concerned, my concerns about the media are everything that I've told you, but it's essentially that there are, every morning, a few people at CBS and NBC and the New York Times and so forth who decide this is the news today. But that news, time and time again, ignores the real reality facing the people of America. Just last night, I held a town meeting in a small town called Springfield, Vermont. And we had 250 people out to talk about poverty. And they were not intellectuals, they were not academics, they were poor people. And they wanted to talk about the experiences of their lives, living without health care, working at Walmarts, and so forth and so on. Think about what would be happening in this country politically if we had serious discussion on those issues, if people knew that they were not alone, if people learned about how change could take place when people work together. So when you talk about media, probably the most significant thing is that corporate media deflects attention away from the reality facing the vast majority of our people. And our job is to bring reality home so we can take a cold, hard look at what goes on and then figure out how we can improve the situation. But if we don't see that reality, we're never going to be able, in my view, to improve it. Just let me carry that argument just for a few more minutes into foreign policy. Our president, as you know, is a great believer in freedom. He wants to bring freedom all over the world. In the 1980s, some of you may remember that President Reagan spent God knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars bringing freedom to the people of Nicaragua. And if many of you were adults at that time and you were reading the newspapers, you knew that almost every single day, Nicaragua, a tiny, tiny country in Central America, every day it was on the front pages of the newspapers. If a Sandinista policeman pushed somebody, it was literally a front page story. Well, the Sandinistas lost, the Contras came to power. You go to your computer and you check out how many stories have been written about Nicaragua in the last 10 or 15 years as they celebrate and enjoy the freedom that the Reagan administration brought to them. And you're not going to find very much written at all. It's a non-story now. But what you might find, if you look hard enough, is that unemployment in Nicaragua, the last time I looked, was about 50%. 50, that's a 50%. Last time I looked, that was a year ago, there were some instances of starvation in Nicaragua. Last time I looked under their free society, and this is a very poor country, a crooked president managed to steal over $100 million, which is quite a feat from a country that has no money at all. Did you ever hear much discussion? Did it make the front page of the New York Times? I don't think so. And that's an important lesson when we talk about, quote unquote, freedom in Iraq as well. One of the issues, obviously, that we are dealing with in Congress right now is the issue of media consolidation. All of you know, or should know, that several years ago, Bush's chairman of the FCC, Colin Powell's son, Michael Powell, led an effort toward what they called media deregulation. And what that meant, essentially, is that at a very dangerous moment in our history, when as a result of mergers and consolidations, fewer and fewer large corporations control what we see, hear, and read, the numbers getting smaller and smaller, these guys said, that's not good enough. We have to make it even fewer. And never forget, that in the waning days of the Soviet Union, you know, people thought, well, there was one newspaper and one television station. There were not. There were many, many newspapers, many radio stations, many television stations. The only problem was is that they were all controlled either by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union or by the government of the Soviet Union. What do you think is happening in America today? You're looking at a handful of large media conglomerates, Disney, Viacom, News Corp, General Electric, Time Warner, and a few others controlling almost everything that you see, hear, and read. It is not just television. It is radio. It's not just radio. It is book publishing. It is magazines. It is the movie houses. And you're seeing fewer and fewer control that. So the Bush administration looked at this problem and said, we want even fewer corporations to control it. So they put through some rules which were a disaster, which would have allowed fewer companies to control what we see, hear, and read. Among many other things, their regulations would have done is done away with rules regarding cross-ownership. What this means is in a town like this, Champaign-Urbana, you could end up, if Bush gets his way, with one media corporation owning your local daily newspaper, a television station, radio stations, and your cable outlet. One station. One company owning all of that. The good news is, to the FCC and Michael Powell's surprise, people rose up against those regulations. And millions of emails came into the FCC, 99% of which said, do not allow for more media consolidation. And then members of Congress began to raise the issue. And we had an interesting coalition coming together, not just progressives like myself, but a lot of conservatives came together on that issue. The end result is that by a 2-1 decision, an appeals court in Pennsylvania threw out what the Bush administration did, and we're back to the drawing boards. So we have some time. But on this issue of media consolidation, I would hope that all of you will stand up and fight. Fight for localism. Fight for a radio and television station locally owned, which will deal with what your school board, what your city council, what the people in this community deal with. Fight for diversity, for people of color to be able to own radio and television stations. Fight to make sure that when you turn on radio or television, you're not just going to hear the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys of the world, but you can hear the Amy Goodmans and other points of view as well. There is another issue that is going on right now that is also of huge concern, which not a lot of people know about, but it is terribly important, and you should know about it, and you should be actively involved on this issue. A couple of months ago, by a very strong vote against my vote, the House of Representatives voted to raise the fines for quote-unquote indecency. And what this means is that if somebody is on the Amy Goodman show and starts throwing out four-letter words, somebody could call up and say, I was absolutely offended by that. And if people wanted, they could fine the guest or her, if this bill goes through, $500,000. And I doubt that you could sustain that. All right? In my state now, the fellow who is head of Vermont Public Television wrote to me and he said, as a result of what they are doing, we are now looking, taking a very hard look at the programming that we do. We do independent films. We're going to look very hard about what we're going to put on the air. How many of you saw a very good film called Saving Private Ryan? Anybody see it? It was, in my view, a very good film. It won 5 Academy Awards, starred Tom Hanks. ABC, last November, in honor of Veterans Day, decided to air that film across the country. Unbelievably, over 60 ABC affiliates on Veterans Day refused to show a film depicting the incredible sacrifice and heroism of those men who fought and died on D-Day and for the liberation of Europe. Didn't show the film. Do you know why they didn't show the film? These are ABC affiliates, not little rinky-dink radio stations. The affiliates were afraid that in the course of the show, the course of the film, profanity was used by soldiers. And they were afraid that if they showed that film depicting in an incredible way the real-life struggles of men under attack, that they would be fined. So if ABC affiliates, ABC, one of the major corporations in our country, is afraid to show an Academy Award-winning film, believe me, there is a chill. There is a movement towards censorship in America. But obviously, it's not only Saving Private Ryan. The Chancellor, a moment ago, mentioned that there was a PBS program whose goal is to show how different people make different products and how we're all one country and we all do different things. Well, they came to my state. They came to Vermont. And it turns out that there was a gay couple who were making maple syrup. And I urge you to buy Vermont maple syrup. It is very good. The new Secretary of Education contacted the PBS and said, we do not want you to send this program out over the airwaves. So they didn't, and people could show it independently, but they didn't send it out nationally. Some of you may remember that MoveOn.org wanted to run an ad, pay for an ad, pay a pretty price, I should tell you, for an ad on the Super Bowl, which criticized President Bush for running up the highest deficit in our history. And CBS said, sorry, we're not going to put that ad on the air. The United Church of Christ developed an ad which essentially said that we as a church welcome gay people into our church. CBS and NBC said, nope, that's too controversial. We can't put that on the air. Sinclair Broadcasting, which owns a number of affiliates, decided not to put a Ted Koppel show on the air, which in a sense was a memorial for men and women who had died in the war in Iraq. It was too anti-war, according to those people. Now, if these guys get away with what they want, which is to raise the indecency fine from $32,000 to $500,000, trust me that people are going to be looking over their shoulders all over this country in terms of what's on the air. Now, that is very bad. Let me tell you what is potentially much worse. And that is we have some people, like Senator Stevens of Alaska, who has said, yes, of course we have to crack down on programming on over-the-air television, which the FCC has regulated for many years. But that's not enough. We now have got to go to cable. We have got to go to satellite. We have got to go to the internet. That's Senator Stevens. Now, what does this mean? What it means in practical terms is that programs like Bill Maher's program, Jon Stewart's program, The Sopranos, Sex and the City, maybe even Friends, because they are a very suggestive group of young people. A lot of sexual innuendo there. They're going to be off the air. They're going to be off the air or pushed very late into the night or radically changed. And for the first time, the FCC is going to venture into cable in an area which many of us, including, interestingly enough, Michael Powell, believes is unconstitutional. Bob McChesney can tell you the difference about regulating over the air as opposed to cable. But the FCC has not gone into cable. It's not over the air. You're paying for it. And they're now saying we can go into your homes, even though you're paying $50 a month or more to get this programming. And because fundamentalists do not like that program, you can't watch that. And then the president tells us about freedom in Iraq. So what do we do? And let me conclude in this way. Number one, for any serious progressive, the issue of media consolidation, the issue of censorship, the fight to create a media where different points of view can be heard, the fight to break down the situation where so few control so much in media should be one of the most important issues, if not the most important issue, that you deal with. And interestingly enough, on that issue, you're going to find a lot of support out there from people with very different political persuasions. Very few people think that it is the American way to have a few corporations controlling what we learn about and what we see and what we hear. I hope that you will be involved in the issue of media consolidation. We can win this struggle. I can tell you, because I talked to Michael Powell about it, he was stunned by the grassroots opposition to what he and his friends were trying to do. And people like Bob McChesney and others and you really woke them up. They thought that people would be asleep at the switch. Who cares about some abstract? Who knows what the FCC is? Who cares about FCC rulemaking? That's what they were hoping, but they were hit with a big surprise. And in terms of the censorship issue, reach out to everybody you know. People do not have to be progressive. People do not even have to be political to know that it ain't right for commissars in Washington, D.C. to tell them whether or not they can watch The Sopranos. So I think that this is an issue that can generate a lot of public support. I think that the Bush administration has completely overreached on that issue, and I think we can win it. So, as a result of the work that many of you have done, issues of media have now risen substantially in terms of public discourse in America. This issue is so significant that even the media occasionally mentions it. So we're making progress. And I know Bob McChesney tells me that every time he holds a forum, more and more people come than they anticipate. So it is a huge issue. If we believe in a vibrant democracy, it's an issue that we must be concerned about. It's an issue that we can win. And when we open up media in America and we allow the people to hear different points of view, we can begin to change America in all the ways that it must be changed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Sanders, for that wonderful speech. Our next speaker will also be speaking tomorrow morning. You'll see in your program, so be sure to catch her then. Her name is Naomi Klein. I'm sure many of you are familiar with her. She came to my attention at first maybe 5 years ago with her book, No Logo, which was, for a critical book, almost a bestseller. Was it a bestseller? It was awfully close. I mean, everyone was reading it. It captured a generation's imagination. Students have used it and loved it. I've used it in my classes. And people just have been reading it because it was really the first synthesis of a critique that connected what was going on globally with the economy and the political economy with the sort of mindless commercialism at home and connected the dots and showed that there was a generation and a world of people who wanted an alternative, that weren't satisfied with the status quo. It's an extraordinary work, one of the great books. Now, something that happens when a young writer writes a great book like that, and we see it in academia a lot, is they're one-hit wonders. You know, they write one great book, and then they go, sort of, you don't hear from them again. Any concern that Naomi Klein was a one-hit wonder ended almost immediately. She has gone on to become one of the really outstanding journalists in the world today, covering international politics and affairs. As a filmmaker, she went to Argentina and made a documentary, The Take, highly acclaimed, many people have seen here, on the extraordinary developments in Argentina after their currency collapsed as workers in that country tried to reconstruct their society, taking their factories into their own hands and really suggesting an alternative way to organize life in a country that was in an absolutely wretched conditions. Her new work on Iraq, on U.S. militarism, on the reconstruction of economies, I think is her best work ever. I mean, her new book she's working on, I can hardly wait to see. It's going to be so terrific. Please welcome me in joining Naomi Klein.
Thank you so much, Bob. I'm very pleased to be here. I've been sitting over there quietly having a nervous breakdown. I made two very, very serious mistakes this evening. The first was while I was listening to Seymour Hersh sort of very casually give his wonderful lecture earlier, reading from the newspaper and sort of ad-libbing, I decided to tear up my prepared speech and sort of made entirely new notes and brought some scraps of paper. And then I realized as I was sitting there that I can't read my writing. It's almost entirely illegible. And I'm not Seymour Hersh. So that was my first mistake. And my second mistake was allowing Bob to convince me that I should speak after Bernie Sanders. So I was considering bribing Amy to let me trade places with her, but then I realized that was just going to make it worse. So I'm just going to get it over with. No, I didn't mean that. I made a few more notes while I was listening to Representative Sanders. I was thinking about what has happened in the year since Seymour Hersh broke the Abu Ghraib story. I was in Iraq at around that time, and in fact, we knew, as Seymour Hersh did, that these abuses were going on. Everybody was talking about it. In fact, many Iraqis speculated about why it was happening, and they have a great deal of experience living under a torture regime. And many people I talked to believed that the Americans were torturing people in Abu Ghraib for the same reason that Saddam tortured people in Abu Ghraib, which was not to get information, but to do what torture is actually good at. Torture's not good at getting information. It gets very unreliable information. We've already seen forced confessions come out of Guantanamo that have been dismissed out of hand. Canadian-Syrian named Harar is the most famous rendition case. He changed planes at John F. Kennedy Airport on the way back from a family vacation in Tunisia and wound up on a unmarked plane that first took him to Jordan, where he was then rendered to Syria and kept in a cell the size of a grave for 10 months, taken out to be tortured periodically. He confessed. I mean, everybody confesses in these situations, but of course, when he came out, this was immediately dismissed as absolute nonsense by the Syrians, the Americans, and the Canadians. And there are no charges against Maher Arar. And in fact, he's forced the Canadian government to have a public inquiry about what happened to him. So torture's not good at getting information. But we have this absurd debate in this country about whether or not torture works. Nobody talks about this in any other country. In every other country, people understand that torture, and in fact, when we talk about it with relation to other countries, we understand that torture serves an entirely other purpose, which is to spread fear, which is to break people down. That's why it's called breaking them down or softening them up. But it's not just the individual who is broken down by terror. It's the broader community that learns about the terror and sees it and hears it and absorbs it as an incredibly menacing warning about dissenting. Now, this lesson has been absorbed and learned in this country, but it has primarily been absorbed in Muslim communities, in Arab American communities, spreading out to South Asian communities, and the so-called mainstream of American society has remained insulated from the reality of the 1-2 punch of every authoritarian regime. I'm not afraid of those words anymore. Which is surveillance on the one hand and the ever-present threat of torture on the other. We are watching you. We are watching your every move. We can subpoena. Actually, we don't even have to subpoena. We can just grab any list we want, any membership, any library card, any website you visit. And the ultimate price that you will pay is that you could be disappeared. I was talking to Michael Ratner the other day from the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he said, Guantanamo is a deep, dark hole that they can throw you in. I was talking to John Sifton, a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. He said Guantanamo is synonymous for disappearances. It's a warning that interrogators are using the world over. Cooperate with us, or you will be sent to Guantanamo, which is a synonym for disappearances. Torture works. That's its dirty secret. That's the dirty secret about torture that we don't hear in the media. It works, just not as an interrogation technique. It works to spread fear and terror. It is a technique, tried and true, of state terror, which is why torture can never be wholly private. There's some kinds of information that they don't want to get out. And we saw that with Seymour Hersh's expose. They don't want gaping evidence of illegal activities, photographs, that people can be indicted for to get out. No, they don't want that. But they do want certain types of information to get out. It was the Defense Department that leaked the original photographs from Guantanamo Bay of prisoners kneeling in the hot sun with GIs pointing their guns at them, pictures of humiliation, saying, "You are animals in cages." They leaked those pictures to the press. They released those pictures to the press and said, show them to the world, because torture is about spreading fear. If it's wholly private, It doesn't work. If only the person facing the torture knows about it, it doesn't work. In Buenos Aires, during the Dirty War, the generals used to build their concentration camps where they would torture people and then disappear them downtown in athletic clubs so that the neighbors could hear the screams. And at the same time, they would deny that anything was happening. So there would be, and when they would disappear people, they would create what they called a liberated zone, or what Argentinians call the liberated zone, where they would pull up in front of the house of the person being disappeared, block off the street. Guys in uniforms and plain clothes would park a Ford Falcon, which is the car that everybody knew is the car where you were disappeared in. Broad daylight, run into the house, grab somebody, blindfold them, throw them in the back seat, race at breakneck speeds to a concentration camp right downtown. But then when they were challenged about it, they would say, "We're not doing anything." The Argentinians describe this as a state of knowing, not knowing. You know enough to be terrified, but just enough, not enough to demand justice, not enough to demand that the perpetrators of these crimes be brought to justice, a state of knowing, not knowing. And that's the state that we're in right now. So in terms of the 1 year since Seymour Hersh broke that story and those pictures that they didn't want to come out came out, we've come a long way, and it hasn't been a good journey. And I think it's really telling that almost 1 year after that story broke in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and Seymour Hersh alluded to this article in his lecture earlier, The New York Times article ran in what I consider to be an absolutely scandalous cover story, not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before, called "The Salvadorization of Iraq? ? I don't know why they put the question mark, because the story very clearly described what is being called the El Salvador model in Iraq. Now, what was telling about this story, if you compare it with Seymour Hersh's story, is that it was a story about widespread use of torture in Iraq, but it wasn't an expose. It was a planted story by an embedded journalist who was invited by the U.S. military to embed with this so-called elite commando unit, as Seymour Hersh told you, who are basically Saddam's best thugs, trained by a guy named Jim Steele, who was head of the training in El Salvador for the death squads. And he was then, and he witnessed the shaking down of torture suspects, I mean, sorry, terrorism suspects, or even just when they didn't get the guy they were looking for, just grabbing his son, pointing a gun at their head, threatening to kill them. All of this was reported on without any remark or any discussion of the implications of what this meant, but that wasn't enough. If you kept reading and actually followed two turns, because it was kind of buried in the article, you find out that Jim Steele invited the reporter into a detention facility in Samara. Now, this detention facility really reminded me of the facilities that I learned about in Buenos Aires, like the athletic clubs kept right downtown. This was a detention facility in downtown Samara, right next to the city hall in the former library. They converted the library to a torture facility. And the reporter said that he could hear the gunshots from outside. So everybody in the city is hearing these mysterious gunshots from inside a downtown detention center. He goes inside, and he describes seeing people strung up, shackled, blindfolded, naked. He describes sitting at a desk that has blood stains running down it. He describes hearing screams that were so chilling it sounded like the sound an animal would make. Now, the reason why I'm telling you all of this is because, like I said, it wasn't an expose. In fact, it was part of an apparatus which has clearly been embraced by the Bush administration now that they have survived Abu Ghraib, which is to now openly use torture as a threat. And where you see this most clearly is in a new reality television show aired on El Araqiya, which is a U.S.-run television station in Iraq. It's, of course, subcontracted to a private company because we know that private companies do things much better. An American company called the Paris Corporation, no media experience whatsoever. They have finally managed to produce a hit television show. The hit television show is called Terrorism in the Grip of Justice. And what it is an absolutely primitive nightly parade of taking tortured interrogation subjects from detention centers like this, who go on television with black eyes, clearly been beaten, and they are forced to confess. They confess to all kinds of things that are supposed to discredit the resistance. Now, of course, nobody believes these confessions to be true. In fact, there's cases of people confessing to killing people who are still alive. But the larger message of the show is, of course, being absorbed, which is dissent is extremely dangerous. You better stay in line. And torture is being used in exactly the same way that it was used under Saddam. So the two main claims about the Iraq War are, of course, that the Iraqi people were being freed from the tyranny of Saddam. And the two symbols, or two of the major symbols of that tyranny, were torture and the lack of freedom, particularly press freedom. Now, we've seen in Iraq that, in fact, there was an explosion of press freedom in the early days after the invasion. 150 newspapers were launched, and you had television stations like Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya really coming into their own and covering the war. Now, look at where we are 2 years later. I think it is useful to look at what the Bush administration does in Iraq, because they get to do whatever they want. So in some ways, it's sort of a glimpse of their utopia, which very rapidly turns into a dystopia. Maybe I should back up a little bit more. I believe that they did like the idea of bringing democracy to Iraq. And I believe that they actually deluded themselves into thinking that democracy was compatible with U.S. interests in Iraq. And it became clear very, very quickly that this was not the case. That if Iraqis were given the freedom that they wanted, the actual freedom that they wanted, it was directly antithetical to the U.S. goals behind the war. The military bases, control over oil, support for Israel, none of it would happen. None of it would happen. So it's not that they are against democracy per se, but they are very much fair-weather Democrats. And we saw this from Wolfowitz in the lead-up to the war, where he's supposedly the one who believes so strongly in democracy. But Turkey, which is one of the only democracies in the region, the parliament decided not to give U.S. airspace, not to allow the U.S. to use its airspace to stage the invasion. And Wolfowitz went on CNN Turkey and basically had a temper tantrum and called for a military coup. He said that he thought that the military should have stepped in and intervened at that point when the parliament voted against allowing the use of airspace. So that was really, I think, a hint of what was to come of U.S.-style democracy in Iraq. You see the hypocrisy of this claim more clearly than anywhere else in the treatment of journalists in Iraq, particularly Iraqi and Arabic journalists in general. Because what started to happen is that after this original explosion, you can wave me down, just tell me to shut up whenever you want. Okay. After this original explosion of a free press, 150 new newspapers, people started publishing articles that the Coalition Provisional Authority did not like very much. They started publishing articles comparing Paul Bremer to Saddam Hussein, things like that. Didn't go over very well. And in addition to the attacks on Al Jazeera that we heard a lot about, Iraqi journalists started facing more and more attacks. When I was in Baghdad, there was a real turning point, which was when Bremer ordered Muqtada al-Sadr's newspaper to be closed, Al-Hawza. And it was closed, they said, because he was inciting violence against the occupation, and they cited three examples. None of them were an incitement to violence. All of them were simply criticisms of the occupation, including comparing Bremer to Saddam Hussein, saying that they thought there was a strategy to keep Iraqis hungry and desperate so that they wouldn't gain control over the economy, which frankly is what I wrote in Harper's, and nobody tried to get me. And there was one other thing that they said that they didn't like. None of it was an incitement. When this happened, it was seen as really this overpowering evidence of the lie that the invasion was actually about delivering democracy. And that's where you started to see a whole second front open up. And the other aspect of it was that peaceful demonstrations started to be fired on. So this is not part of the narrative that we hear about Iraq, that many people tried nonviolent resistance against the occupation before they took up arms. And they were met with extreme force and extreme violence. There were hearings. The Senate Democratic Policy Committee held hearings about waste, fraud, and abuse by contractors in Iraq, which can just go on forever and ever and ever. Most of it's about Halliburton, obviously. But there was an interesting testimony by Don North, who was hired to work for Al-Araqiya, actually, this U.S.-run television station. And he became a whistleblower. And this is how he described media training in Baghdad. He said, obviously, journalism training was urgently needed. A brutal form of training was delivered by the U.S. Army and CPA officials when they found stories offensive. They visited the offices of offending newspapers and often left them padlocked and in ruins. No mediation, no appeal. So that was almost a year and a half ago, the period that he's describing. And since then, it's gotten immeasurably worse. We hear a little bit about the targeting of Western journalists, the attacks on Western journalists, but there's been a wave of stories that just came out, actually this past week, came out, most of them 5 days ago, where because Western reporters are now basically prisoners in their hotels, they can't go out. They are becoming more and more, they have become almost completely reliant on what are called fixers, which is a nice way of not giving Iraqi journalists credit for their work. Fixers are Iraqi journalists who work for Western news organizations. The original idea of a fixer is that they had local contacts, they would set up interviews for you, and so it really was kind of a glorified secretarial role. Now Iraqi fixers are the journalists on the ground. They're the only ones with any mobility. They're the ones taking photographs, they're the ones shooting video, they're the ones doing interviews, and they bring that back to the Sheraton or the Alhambra or the Green Zone, and it is then put under the names of Western journalists, and sometimes there's like a little thing at the end saying, with files from, and you'll see some Iraqi names, or they'll say, we're not telling you the names of the Iraqis who worked on this article to protect their safety. What's clearly happened is that the U.S. Administration in Iraq has realized that these fixers and translators really are the only independent journalists left in Iraq, and there's been a wave of arrests of these fixers. We just heard this week that U.S. and Iraqi forces are holding 9 Iraqi journalists who are working for these international news organizations, claiming that they're aiding insurgents. And their proof is that they take pictures of things that they don't want pictures being taken of, like long gas lines or an explosion that shows Americans getting hit, things like this. So there's many, many of these cases, and it's just getting worse. I'm going to end now, right? Okay. I just wanted to say one more thing about Seymour Hersh's report, which is that in terms of how far we've fallen in that year, I think we need to understand the role that the media plays, the corporate media is playing, is really as a shock manager, managing our shock. I don't think it's true that we don't care about torture. It's that our outrage, our compassion, our humanity is being very, very carefully managed. And I think that what we see in the incredibly powerful reaction to the original photographs is that we do care. In fact, that our outrage is an awesomely powerful political force. In the years since, by seeing how little happens, how little accountability there is for these kinds of atrocities, watching them get away with it, being told subtly in so many ways that it's more important to care about Terri Schiavo or Michael Jackson or the Pope, these sort of, I guess they're kind of compassion outlet valves or something like that, where the sort of pent-up compassion and humanity is allowed to seep out in these spasms of collective mourning, and then we go back to. But by creating this context where nothing happens in response to these atrocities, then you have a situation like last week where the person in the most iconic image out of Abu Ghraib, which is the hooded man standing on a box, came forward and went on PBS and said, "I'm the man in the hood." And if we remember originally, we were told nobody was electrocuted in Abu Ghraib. You know, it was all fraternity pranks. And that was just a simulated electrocution, and that those cords weren't plugged into anything. Well, he came forward and he said, "I'm the man under the hood, and I was electrocuted so hard I thought my eyeballs were going to fall out." Now, that story didn't make the New York Times, the Washington Post, or any of the networks. So that's how far we've fallen in a year. And I don't think it's because we have compassion fatigue. I don't think it's because we don't care. I think it's because our compassion is being incredibly tightly managed, and that the primary role of corporate media now is to keep our humanity, compassion, and our tremendously powerful outrage under control. So our job here, in many ways, is to access it and let it out and find media that gives us permission and build media that gives us permission to be outraged. I think a really... Thank you. I'm actually just going to end there because I'm out of time. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much, Naomi. Before we go to our last speaker, I just want to say a couple of things. Is Rebecca Livesay here? Rebecca? Okay, up there. And Victor Picard, is Victor here? Victor is back there, is responsible for everything you see here. Rebecca has helped him. He's been an organizer. And Rebecca, too. And thank you so much, Victor, for pulling this off so well. I'm going to get a lot of credit for this. I should get none. Victor should get all of it for what's happened today and what will happen tomorrow. Our last speaker tonight is someone I'm delighted we have joining us. One of the really great developments that's taken place in the last 5 or 6 years, as far as I'm concerned, has been Amy Goodman's emergence as a much more prominent broadcast journalist than she was 5, 10, 15 years ago. And I say this not only because her journalism is outstanding, but also as I've gotten to know her and I've had the privilege of speaking with her several times, just her personal style, her humility, her generosity. You're glad a person like that has success, that people like that are successful. One of the ironies, and Amy and I have talked about this, is sometimes she's attacked as being a partisan journalist, as not being professional, not being objective, not being independent. And I find this nonsensical. And I study the history of journalism, and I've never been happy with that criticism of Amy, because I don't think it reflects a very solid understanding of how journalism works or how it developed in the United States. In fact, I think you can make a very strong case that Amy, and I think Naomi and Seymour Hersh and a bunch of the other people you'll hear in the next couple of days, are truly independent journalists in the best sense of the term. Sure, Amy Goodman's very hard on George W. Bush, but ask John Kerry or Bill Clinton if they got a free ride from her. I think what you find with Amy Goodman is she has one standard and she holds everyone to it. And that's what great journalism should do. One standard, you hold everyone to it. You don't have one standard for some people and a different standard for other people. Same standard applies to everyone. Unfortunately, what's oftentimes called professional journalism today, what Amy Goodman apparently is not part of, some say, All too often, it's simply a report on debates among elites. What people in power are debating, you report on them. That's called neutral. That's called objective. If elites agree on something and aren't debating it, then you can't raise it. Because if you raise it, you're called subjective and unprofessional. And that's the worst thing you want to be called. It's a very bad situation. Weapons of mass destruction. Leading Republicans, leading Democrats basically don't want to argue it. So journalists, for the most part, don't raise the issue because people in power aren't debating it. It's nonsense that journalists should be restricted to what people in power are willing to debate to be good, doing good journalism. And it's also nonsense that this is, by definition, professional journalism. There's nothing in the notion of independent professional journalism or nonpartisan journalism that requires journalists simply to regurgitate or provide stenography to the range of debate among those in power. In fact, back in the 1930s, there was a tremendous debate that emerged on this very issue. Ben Scott, who's here, will be speaking tomorrow, is writing a dissertation on this. It took place in the 1930s when the Newspaper Guild, the great newspaper union, was being formed, and the founders of the guild, George Saldes, Haywood Broun, were firm believers that professional journalism shouldn't simply be regurgitating what people in power say. It shouldn't be just what people in power did their debates and sort of monitoring those debates. Their version, Saldes' version of professional journalism, was that it always should represent everyone outside of power and be critical of everyone in power. That should be the bias towards those who have no power, not towards just monitoring or reflecting the debates of those within power. The classic line, afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. That was the basis they argued, not of a partisan journalism that picked one party over another, but of a truly independent journalism that served the broad interest of a free society. Regrettably, that vision is not very powerful in our professional journalism today. It's alive and well on the margins. You've heard some of the great journalists today talking about it. There are many others. We need a lot more, but more importantly, we need institutions that promote this type of journalism, that protect it, nurture it, spawn it, and stand up for journalists who exercise it. We're very fortunate today to have one of the truly outstanding broadcast journalists of our times. Please join me in welcoming Amy Goodman.
It is a great honor to be here at this conference and also to be here in Urbana-Champaign, which really is, I don't know if we would call it a breeding ground, but a gold mine of independent media activity. It really is an example of the hope for the future as we talk about how important it is that we have independent media. I just spent the hour before we got together talking to Randall Cotton and Sasha Meinrath. Randall Cotton telling me the story of how Democracy Now! Got on public access TV here in Urbana. And what it took, and I think it's a very interesting model. A group of people, because it airs every day at 4 o'clock on WEFT, 90.1 FM, said, oh, this is television. Why don't we get it on public access TV? But the mayor wasn't interested. Well, that shouldn't be the case when it comes to public access TV. It's public access. It shouldn't be determined by the mayor. So it took time. It took going to farmers markets and other places and gathering petitions. I think you had something like 1,200 signatures. Went to the Cable Commission, and then the City Council got involved. Ultimately, the Cable Commission voted unanimously for it, as did, amazingly enough, the City Council. And it just kept gaining momentum. It took some work. It's what democracy feels like, looks like, acts like. People getting involved to decide what media they want in town. And ultimately, I think it was the City Council that finally passed a resolution that said that Democracy Now! Was to air beginning January 3rd, 2005 at 7 o'clock in the morning, Channel 6 every morning. And finally, that ultimately is what is happening, and it is because of not just a small group of dedicated people, but increasingly more. And what I've heard now in these last few months, and this is really the goal of Democracy Now!, is all of the people who now want to get involved with public access TV to make their own local programs. That is what this is all about. And then, coming to this place that really is the site of support for indie media all over this country. I mean, we all know about the IMCs, the Indie Media Centers, the most important beginning, 1999, the day of the, or the days of wrath in Seattle, the Battle of Seattle, when 50,000 people across the political spectrum, from nurses and doctors and farmers and environmentalists and trade unionists and students, high school kids and college kids, took to the streets in the largest export city in this country. Then Boeing was there, Microsoft and Amazon.com and other large corporations. And people were beginning to learn, just like they didn't know about the FCC, who would have thought that anyone would care about this quite secret bureaucratic organization called the World Trade Organization, born in Geneva in 1995, that was overturning the laws of democratically elected legislatures in this country and around the world. If corporations lost at the city council level or at a state legislature level, for example, if a community said, we don't want to do business with a company doing business with the Indonesian military or the Burmese regime, when corporations lost at that level, they could overturn it at the World Trade Organization level and say it's an illegal barrier to trade. And so people started to get wise to this, or people concerned about their food supply and whether it was bioengineered or, you know, whether hormones were being injected into the beef. Okay, maybe you couldn't beat it at the local level. And so you moved in at a supranational level at the World Trade Organization. And people said no, and it was this remarkable global uprising against corporate power. But there was also this group of people who were a part of that who said, we are not going to view this global uprising against corporate power through a corporate lens. And so people got out their papers and their pencils and their tape recorders and their pens and their video cameras, and they took to the streets too. And that's where really the blossoming of the indie media movement, indiemedia.org, was born. And when people got tear gas with their video cameras, they handed them off to someone else, or they got arrested and they got taken away. And all of these images went on the website and all of the first-hand accounts. And as the mayor and the police chief were saying, we're not shooting rubber bullets, we're picking them up by the handfuls in the streets, as they're acting as a megaphone for those in power, as the city of Seattle is closed down for only the second time, martial law in that city since World War II. And the Indie Media Center started to get more hits than CNN.com. And it was a mighty force to contend with. And here, amazingly enough, the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, the sponsor of many indie media centers from Washington to Boston to New York, all over the country, the site here. And as this indie media center grew, I came here a few years ago and I saw it was a lovely space that people came to for concerts and information. And now, this week, hearing that the indie media center has bought the post office. And a low-power FM station, Radio Free Urbana, is going to be going on the air next month, and it's also the site of indie media and so much more, talking about the post office, talking about sending the message around the world that indie media is on the move. Yes, I'm very proud to be here right now. Well, I come from Pacifica Radio, which was founded 56 years ago by a man named Lou Hill, who was a conscientious objector in World War II. And when he came out of the detention camps, he said there has to be a media outlet that is not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was born. Not run by corporations, as George Gerbner at the Annenberg School, University of Pennsylvania, says, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell, that are raising our children today. And so the first Pacifica station, KPFA, went on air in 1949 in Berkeley. Second one 10 years later in Los Angeles, KPFK. Third one, my station, WBAI in New York in 1960. WPFW in Washington in 1977. KPFT in Houston, 1970. KPFT is the only radio station in the country whose transmitter was blown up not once but twice in the first year of operation by the Ku Klux Klan. And I don't know if it was the Exalted Cyclops or the Grand Dragon, because I often confuse their titles, but when they took credit, they said it was their proudest act, because they understood how dangerous Pacifica is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, that breaks down the caricatures and the stereotypes that fuel the bigotry that feed these groups. I really do think that the Abu Ghraib prison scandal began long before the first low-level soldier laid a finger on the first Iraqi prisoner. I mean, yes, there's the chain of command, and I always talk about Cy Hirsch's expose of this everywhere I go and how important it was. And I was recently speaking in Tampa Bay, you know, the home of CENTCOM, Central Command, and MacDill Air Base, and also wonderful community media. WMNF, a Florida community radio station that has now built a station three times its size in their parking lot, because indie media, independent media, is on the move. And Speak Up Tampa Bay, public access in Tampa Bay, both of those together forming a very important source, well, of information. So there you've got indie media, you've got CENTCOM, you've got MacDill Air Base. And after giving the talk and talking about the chain of command and how everyone should read Cy Hirsch's book, a woman came up to me, because I was saying, you know, you have to look at the chain of command now. Human Rights Watch, by the way, has come out with a report and a demand calling for a special prosecutor to investigate particularly Donald Rumsfeld and the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, saying Alberto Gonzalez can't do this. And this woman comes up to me and she says, why don't you refer to it as the Cheney of command? Maybe that will be Cy's next book. But anyway. But it goes beyond the chain of command, and yes, that must be investigated to the very top, and Alberto Gonzalez can't do it. Yes, the man who's become Attorney General, who really laid the legal groundwork for the torture at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib by saying that the Geneva Conventions don't apply, that they're quaint. And by the way, one of the most important stories that isn't covered in this country is the level of resistance in the military. From the lowest levels to the highest levels. A couple months ago, we had Brigadier General James Cullen in our studio. He was one of those generals and admirals who had sent a letter to the Senate committee that was going to vote out to confirm Alberto Gonzalez, saying he is a threat to the servicemen and women of this country. Now, that's a very important story. Because if this is how people are treated who are imprisoned by the United States, what will happen to U.S. servicemen and women if they're caught in other parts of the world? And on that point, I want to follow this thread of thought, but we've been on this Unembed the Media tour for a couple months now. Unembed the media, by the way. That is what we have to do. More powerful than any bomb, more powerful than any missile. The Pentagon has deployed the U.S. media, and we have to unembed it. The media are the most powerful institutions on earth. But on this tour, I was down in Tucson just about a week ago on the border and talking at the convention center. And at the convention center hotel the next morning, there's this group of older men, and they're all wearing military caps and everything. They had just celebrated the night before, April 29th, the 60th anniversary of their liberation from German POW camps. They were held by the Luftwaffe. They were the airmen who were shot down. They were the guys that were strafing the radar so that the bombardiers wouldn't get shot down. And they had just had this big dinner the night before. Oh, they decided on their motto. You know, they're getting older, no question. Their motto is, they're concerned, are they gonna even be able to have another celebration together, anniversary? Don't go to heaven till 07, because that's a big anniversary. But anyway, so they So I went up to this guy with this cap on, and it said Tuskegee Airman, African-American survivor of the detention camp, had been shot down. His name is Alexander Jefferson, and he lives in Detroit. He just wrote a book about his experience. And I said, so what was it like? This is the 60th anniversary. What was it like in this POW camp? And he said, sure be Mississippi. And he described coming in the ship he came into New York Harbor as a hero with the others who had been liberated. It was called the Lejeune. They came and they saw the Statue of Liberty, and they docked. They came down the gangplank, incredibly proud. They were coming home. They had survived. And a guy at the end said, whites to the left, niggers to the right. Then there was a guy, an airman named Irv Baum, and he's from Napa, California. And he was standing next to Alexander Jefferson. And I said, what do you think about what's happening at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib? And he said, the Geneva Conventions are the only thing that saved us. And he said, when he hears about this, when he sees the pictures, he can only think SS. He said, they were lucky enough to be held by the Luftwaffe, believe it or not, the German air army. He said, because at least they respected the Geneva Conventions once you got into this camp. He said, but if you fell into the hands of the SS, tortured, shot, killed. And he said, that's all he can think of every time he hears these descriptions. And he too said what Brigadier General James Cullen said. He said, this is a threat to the servicemen and women of this country. What is going to happen to them? Just another story that we don't hear. We hear about their stories of being survivors of POW camps, as we should. But what these men actually have to say beyond the real life experiences. These are not theoretical concepts, Geneva Conventions. It's what saves lives. But talking about the torture beginning before the first low-level soldier laid a finger on the Iraqi prisoner, it's not just the chain of command to the top that has to be investigated. We have to look at the media culture in this country, because I think somehow some of these soldiers felt like they had a kind of permission. Where from? Well, we live in a media culture where the average soundbite 6, 7, 8, 9 seconds. What can be said in that amount of time? You can say Saddam Hussein is like Hitler, and you're ready for prime time. Takes about 4 seconds. Everyone knows what you're talking about. If you have something else to say, perhaps that U.S. officials might be guilty of war crimes, actually, that takes less than 8 seconds, but you sound crazy. Because that you don't often hear on television. And so you need to explain yourself. What are the Geneva Conventions? What are the Nuremberg Principles? What are war crimes? And for that, you do not have time. It's not a political edit, they say. You're just not quite there yet. And that's true for so many issues. I've been invited on Hardball a few times, believe it or not, MSNBC. Often they have me on to talk about the occupation, or at least they say that's what I'll be invited on to talk about. But it always changes once you get there. And it's usually never the topic you come in to speak about. And you only have 3 minutes to talk about this new issue. I seem to have become their Social Security expert. I am not sure why. And it's funny, I bumped into Katrina Vandenhoevel. I was coming out, once again, a little shell-shocked from the experience. And she was going in. She said she had told herself she wasn't going to do it anymore because every time she comes in, they talk about a wholly different issue. So anyway, you know the experience, Bernie. I have become their Social Security expert, and so I think it is my responsibility to learn all the facts and figures, to talk about why, you know, this is not the kind of crisis they're talking about. And so I've become prepared, but I'm often put up against this right-wing pundit from the San Francisco Chronicle. And I don't like to say conservative, because I consider myself conservative in many ways. But, you know, right-wing pundit, who they had told me this time, one of these times, that I was going to come on and talk about the invasion, and then I got there, and I was talking about Social Security. I think she was surprised, too, because she had written an article about the occupation, fully in support of it. And I had read this article, and I had carefully noted what I was going to say. So we were both prepared for the fight. But instead, they asked us what we thought of Social Security. So we were both surprised. And she said that she, something like, she cannot believe the way old people burden young people in this society. And, you know, I know the numbers, and I was just about to start spouting them, but I thought, oh, come on, everyone's eyes glaze over when you do that. I knew we only had a few minutes, so I didn't have time to ask her. I don't know what kind of relationship she has with her parents. So I quoted Gandhi. I thought that might be a little new to MSNBC. And I said, you know, he was asked the question, what do you think of Western civilization? He said, I think it would be a good idea. And I said, what kind of society do you want to live in? I mean, the next thing she's going to say is these barbaric babies who burden their parents. But we have to break the sound barrier. And I really do think that all these political labels are breaking down right now. Conservative, liberal, they just don't apply when it comes to Social Security, when it comes to issues of privacy, when it comes to issues of corporate control and media consolidation. It was Trent Lott as well as Barbara Boxer that raked Michael Powell over the coals before their Senate committee. They know what happens when one media mogul in town who owns everything decides they don't like one of these politicians and targets them. And so I think it's very important not to assume immediately who your allies are, or rather who perhaps your political enemies are, because it may not be true. I think things are really turning around in this country. On one of these shows just a few weeks ago on Hardball, when I was brought back on to talk about, well, they at least told me this time, media coverage of the Terri Schiavo case. And that is what we talked about. But I decided that, I know I'm going to talk about the occupation no matter what happens. They're not going to be the one to frame this discussion, because it was right after the second anniversary of the invasion, and I felt it was very important. The media hardly touched this. So, you know, how to bring this around. So I sat in the studio in Washington, and I said, what do you think? You know what happened with Terri Schiavo. For 2 weeks, nonstop coverage in the corporate media of the Terri Schiavo case. Not to say it isn't a tragic, you know, story that too many of us will have to deal with. But you'd think we'd learn something in the 2 weeks of nonstop coverage. I was talking to someone who was in a meeting in France of international health workers from around the world dealing with malaria and TB. You know how many millions of people have died? They were all talking about the Terri Schiavo case. That's the power of the media. This one woman, she said she came to morning, noon, and night. Everyone was focused on whether she would live or die. And they were there to talk about whether millions would live or die. That is why we have to take the media back. It is a matter of life and death. But 2 weeks, what do we get from this 2 weeks of coverage? And what matters is television, because that's where most people get their information, particularly from the late night comics. But why it's so important to build this independent media infrastructure that includes television and radio and the internet and all the different forms as we build it all together, collaborate together. But in that 2 weeks, did we learn For example, the Tom DeLay, the man that led the charge for congressional intervention to cover up the charges against him, had made this painful decision himself in the late 80s with his brothers and his mom in the hospital when his father was in a coma from a freak accident in their backyard. They had decided not to continue any kind of artificial support for their father. And what about Mr. Schindler, Terry's dad, who made that very same decision for his own mother? She had gotten pneumonia, and he had made this painful decision that should be private with his family, with his doctors. Did we learn about this? Did we learn who the small group of protesters who they focused on nonstop in front of the hospice? I'm not talking about the family, the small group of protesters led by Randall Terry, right, founder of Operation Rescue. I covered him for years in New York on the sidewalks as he blocked women's access to health care. I hardly recognized him. He was older, and the media didn't talk about him in that way. They realized, oh, that's Randall Terry. I often wonder if Terry is short for terrorizing women. But there they were, and every time this small group of protesters went to the microphone, the media cut away, giving us the illusion that this country was deeply divided over this issue. It is not. The polls show that between 80 and 90% of Americans were against the congressional intervention, were against President Bush flying back in the middle of the night and signing off on the legislation in his pajamas, against. And that more than 60% of evangelicals were against this. The lines are breaking down, but instead we had this false sense of it's balanced, it's divided. Because when they were moved to go to a microphone, the networks cut away from their regularly scheduled programs. And so when they asked, what do I think of the media coverage of the Terri Schiavo case, I said, let it be a model for the coverage of all protest in this country. 2 weeks before the second anniversary of the invasion, March 19th, 800 protests around this country, tens of thousands of people marched, rallied, vigiled in tiny protests and in big protests. Outside Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, North Carolina, thousands of people gathered. And people like Camilo Mejia spoke up, the Florida Army National Guardsman who went to Iraq, came back after 6 months, was on leave, and then refused to return, said he didn't want to be a part of the torture and abuse that he had witnessed himself, not at Abu Ghraib, but al-Assad, a place that Rumsfeld went to. He offered to testify before Congress. He applied for conscientious objector status. He wanted to talk about what he had experienced. Instead, he was the first soldier to be court-martialed for refusing to return to Iraq, and he served almost a year in the brig in prison. You have to ask, if we lived in a just society, who would be behind bars and who would be free? And now, Camilo Mejia, together with Aiden Delgado, another soldier who said no, ultimately had his weapons taken away from him in Iraq, although he remained there and he was at Abu Ghraib and came back and bravely talked about what he had witnessed, have now flown to California to be with Pablo Paredes, who is being court-martialed tomorrow, the young U.S. Navy sailor in California who refused to get on the ship to be deployed to Iraq. And together they will stand. Naomi Klein is going there tomorrow, as they are going to hold a rally. The next day, Dr. Kenneth Benderman will be court-martialed. Same story, refusing, saying no. The level of resistance in the military that the Pentagon doesn't want you to know about. We should know these people's names. We should know their stories. And so there was the Florida Army National Guardsman, Camilo Mejia, at Fort Bragg in New York. Javier Cosso was standing in Central Park with thousands of others. He lost his brother Jose Cosso. He worked for Telecinco Television. He was at the Palestine Hotel on April 8th, remember the day before the U.S. Marines pulled down the Saddam Hussein statue in Firdaus Square. And Jose Coso was filming on the balcony. The U.S. military had first opened fire around the Al Jazeera offices, killing Tariq Ayoub, a young reporter for Al Jazeera, who had gone on the roof with the cameraman to fix the camera. And he was first killed. And then the military, the U.S. military, moved on Abu Dhabi and then over to the Palestine Hotel. And they opened fire. Now, everyone in the world knew who was in the Palestine Hotel. Hundreds of unembedded reporters. Sites were set on the 14th floor, and they opened fire, and Jose died. And Javier has come to this country to ask for an independent investigation into the killing of journalists in Iraq. Yes, for his brother Jose, but also for all reporters. And that protects us all. This idea of, or the question of, with the numbers that we're seeing, I mean, Al Jazeera saying they gave the coordinates of the Al Jazeera offices repeatedly to the military. Maybe that was their first mistake. But the whole question of shooting the messenger and how important it is that we all stand together in a journalistic gathering, that we ask the very serious questions about what is happening here. And so on the Terry Schiavo case that day, March 19th, 2 weeks before, why it's so important that we get these other voices out, why the protests are uncovered. I stayed home to watch the media coverage. I watched every nightly newscast March 19th on the anniversary of the invasion. Not one of them interviewed a protester. All the ingredients were there when you learn in journalism school, firsthand, closest to the story, right? Camilo Mejia or Javier, who's speaking for his brother because he can no longer speak. Where were these people? CNN, by the end of the day, they did have a little riff that was going every 20 minutes or so. 4,000 people in Japan were protesting against war. Now, this is encouraging, but it wasn't CNN International. It was CNN Domestic. Right in their backyard, people were protesting. Where is the coverage? Where is the forum for those voices? It is absolutely critical. In the lead up to the invasion, FAIR did a study of the four major nightly newscasts, NBC, ABC, CBS, and the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. In the 2 weeks around Colin Powell giving his address at the UN, his push for war. Four major nightly newscasts. There were 393 interviews done around war. Only three were with anti-war representatives, anti-war leaders. Three of almost 400. That is no longer mainstream media. That is an extreme media, beating the drums for war. Mainstream media at that time, the majority of people were opposed to the invasion for more inspections and more diplomacy. This is why it is absolutely critical we take back the media. We are talking about voices that are being silenced that are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media. I think it's very important when we look at the embedding of the media. Victoria Clark, who hailed from Hill and Knowlton, becomes the Pentagon spokesperson, hails the embedding process as a spectacular success. In fact, the media reached an all-time low, but it didn't just start now. We are moving in on the 60th anniversary of the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I think it's instructive to go back to that time, to look at two reporters, one independent and one working for the New York Times, and how they covered the bombing, as this will get more and more attention, or at least the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki will on August 6th and August 9th. And as I travel around the country, there are major preparations for protest. It was in Omaha, Nebraska. Hundreds of people there for a Peace and Justice Expo. They'll be speaking out at STRATCOM, Strategic Command, from August 6th to August 9th, Los Alamos. That's going to be very big. In fact, already the Santa Fe City Council has passed a resolution for getting rid of nuclear weapons in the world, for abolition. And this is happening in city councils and in communities around the country. But I want to look at just two reporters. One is Wilfred Burchett, independent reporter, and one is William Lawrence, the reporter for the New York Times. Wilfred Burchett, after the dropping of the bombs, wanted to see with his own eyes the dawn of the nuclear age. At the time, General MacArthur had declared the whole area of southern Japan off limits. Most of the press went off a barge off the coast of Japan to cover the Japanese surrender. But instead, he got on a train, and he traveled for 30 hours to Hiroshima and was devastated by the devastation. Saw people's shadows burnt in the sides of buildings, saw the skin melting off people's arms, saw people dying not from the initial impact, but from something else that he didn't even have the words to describe. And he sat down in the rubble with his Hermes typewriter, and he tapped out the words, "I write this as a warning to the world." It was a report that rocked the world, and the U.S. military had to deal with this very quickly. And so they called a group of reporters back to New Mexico, General Leslie Groves, who ran the Manhattan Project that developed the atomic bomb. Chief among those reporters was William Lawrence of the New York Times. The general was not disappointed with his reports. Lawrence's front page story, headlined, "U.S. Atom Bomb Site Belies Tokyo Tales. Tests on New Mexico Range Confirmed that Blast, Not Radiation, Took Toll." That ran on September 12, 1945, following a three-day delay to clear military censors. He said, "This historic ground in New Mexico, scene of the first atomic explosion on Earth and cradle of a new era in civilization, gave the most effective answer today to Japanese propaganda that radiation responsible for deaths even after the day of the explosion, August 6th, and that people entering Hiroshima had contracted mysterious maladies due to persistent radioactivity." In the course of the tour, by the way, General Groves' driver, a 29-year-old soldier named Patrick Stout, posed in the center of a bomb crater for photographs. A scientist later informed Stout he'd been exposed to high levels of radiation. He died of leukemia in 1969 and was given service-connected disability payments by the Army in apparent recognition that radiation was the cause. But Lawrence's words were quite amazing as he described the dawn of the nuclear age. By the way, he was in the squadron that dropped the bombs on Nagasaki, William Lawrence. He said, describing the bombing of Nagasaki, "Awestruck, we watched it shoot upward like a meteor coming from the Earth instead of from outer space, becoming ever more alive as it climbed skyward through the white clouds. It was a living thing, a new species of being born right before our incredulous eyes." He said, "Being close to it and watching it as it was being fashioned into a living thing so exquisitely shaped that any sculptor would be proud to have created it, one felt oneself in the presence of the supernatural." He wrote a series of 10 articles about the dropping of the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for those reports. It turned out that he was also on the payroll of the Pentagon. Yes, William Lawrence, just before this, had been approached by General Leslie Groves. In March 45, Groves went to the New York Times and held a secret meeting with Lawrence to offer him a job writing press releases for the Manhattan Project, the U.S. program to develop atomic weapons. The intent was to explain the intricacies of the atomic bomb's operating principles in layman's language, said the Times. Lawrence also helped write statements on the bomb for President Truman and Secretary of War Henry Stimson. We've called for the New York Times to be stripped of this Pulitzer. It is very important that we unembed the media and challenge the models of a media that is a part of the powers it is supposed to cover. There is a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we are supposed to be the check and balance on government. We are supposed to be holding those in power accountable. And when we look at Michael Powell, son of Colin Powell, who tried to launch the largest media consolidation this country has ever seen. His father helps to lead the war in Iraq. The son leads the war on diversity of voices here at home. We have to acknowledge that militarism and media monopoly go hand in hand, and we have to break the unholy alliance. I just wanted to end briefly with two more stories about the power of how we can get word out, how independent media really can break the sound barrier if we work together. One is the story of Haiti, which is very much on my mind today as Yvonne Neptune, the ousted Haitian prime minister, lies near death, jailed since last June, February 2004. The Haitian president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, ousted in what he called a modern-day kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States. Today, for those of you who listen to or watch Democracy Now!, you heard our hour interviewing President Aristide in exile in South Africa. But it is a story that has to continue to be told. This country in crisis connected us to us, unfortunately, through the barrel of a gun and through U.S. foreign policy. It should be celebrating now. 2004 was its jubilee year. 200 years, the oldest black republic in the world, born of a slave uprising in 1804, the U.S. Congress not wanting to recognize the republic for decades, afraid it would inspire slaves in this country to rise up. And then, just after President Aristide was first elected, the first democratically elected leader in Haiti in 2001, he's ousted in a coup that lasts for 3 years. One of the leaders of that coup, FRAP leader Emmanuel Constant, who walks free in the streets of New York today, on the payroll of the U.S. intelligence agencies as he was involved in that coup. Alan Nairn, a great journalist, exposed this in The Nation magazine on the payroll of the DIA. And I raise that because the number two man in FRAP at that time was Louis Jodel Chamblain, who now, 10 years later, is involved in the coup once again against the re-elected President Aristide. On March 1st last year, we didn't know what had happened to Aristides that weekend. We had just interviewed the First Lady of Haiti, Mildred Aristide, on Friday, February 27, 2004. She said, "We're not going to leave." And then they disappeared. Then we got a call from Congressmember Maxine Waters and Randall Robinson of TransAfrica. They said the Aristides had just called them. They were in the Central African Republic. According to the U.S. media, if they even covered it, somehow they had taken up residence there. But they said that Aristides said he'd been kidnapped, and he said that the U.S. was behind it. And so we put this story on the air, and our transcripts we put on our website at democracynow.org, and corporate network reporters took those transcripts to the Pentagon and the White House. Rumsfeld was at the Pentagon press briefing that day, and they asked him, "Is it true what Pacifica's reporting?" And he laughed, and then he said, "That's ridiculous, but I've learned in my years as a reporter, when a politician says that's ridiculous, you're probably on the right track." And then 2 weeks later, the small delegation led by Robinson and Congressmember Waters decided to charter a small plane and go two-thirds of the way around the world to the Central African Republic to pick up the Aristides, calling the bluff of the most powerful country on earth, the United States, saying they were free to go. Well, if they were free to go, then they would take them home. And so I chronicled this trip. We got on a plane in Miami, went from there to St. Thomas, across the Atlantic to Dakar, Senegal, to the Central African Republic, where they went to negotiate with the dictator, Bazize, who was himself celebrating the first anniversary of his coup. The U.S. really knows how to choose them. And as the delegation negotiated with him for 7 hours, President Aristide said to me, "Wes Bazize says he's considering their offer. He's really going off to get his marching orders from the United States and France." And finally, they had no choice. If they weren't being held in captivity, they had to let them go. And so they did. And as this was all unfolding, AP would take all of the reports from our satellite phone and put them out around the world. And then we got back on the plane and made our way back from Central African Republic to Dakar, Senegal, to the Cape Verde Islands across the Atlantic. And there, President Aristide told his story. As we flew over the Atlantic, he said, On February 29th, a number two man in the U.S. Embassy in Haiti came to their home and said that they could die, thousands of Haitians could die, if they didn't leave immediately. He said he wanted to speak to the press, thought he was being taken to the press. Instead, he was hustled onto this plane with U.S. military and security, with Mildred Aristide. They were told not even to lift the shade to know where they were going. They traveled for some 24 hours and ended up dumped in this remote area of Africa where it's difficult to get a cell phone call out, let alone leave. And so we arrived in Barbados, and as we were landing in Barbados, we were getting word that Rumsfeld, Rice, and Powell were saying the Aristides were not to return to this hemisphere. Whose hemisphere? And that the U.S. ambassador to Haiti, James Foley, was saying Aristide was not to come within 150 miles of Haiti. Whose country? And then we arrived in Jamaica, where they'd been invited by P.J. Patterson, the prime minister, who's also head of CARICOM, which has never accepted the new, quote, de facto government of Haiti, led by Gerard Latortue. And as they landed, I talked to CNN on the phone, and they said they were going to go live with the report. I said, let me bring over Congressmember Waters. They said, no, no, no. The host is doing some kind of lifestyle show. He's not going to know what you're talking about. Just explain what's happened. And I thought I think he thought I was doing some vacation report, because he said, so what's happening in Jamaica? We're on the tarmac at the airport. And I said, well, this historic delegation has just arrived. The Aristides have been returned to this hemisphere. And you could see in his other ear, you could tell that he's now being quickly informed about what's going on. And he suddenly says, what about the violence? You know, suggesting that Aristide would inspire violence if he came to this hemisphere. I said, I'm very glad that you raised that issue, the violence. Who is involved with this coup? Who is the U.S. working with? For example, Jodel Chamblain, the number two man in FRAP, involved in the coup 10 years ago, found guilty in absentia of the murder of the Justice Minister, Guy Mallory, in 1993, found guilty in absentia of the murder of a Haitian businessman named Antoine Ismery. I had spent time at his house. Incredibly brave man who marched in a procession during the coup, remembering a massacre that had taken place 5 years before on another September 11th. And as he marched in the midst of the coup of 1993 with a small group of people, he was brought behind a church, pushed to his knees, and in cold blood, in broad daylight, he was executed. Jodel Chamblain was found guilty of that murder in absentia. These are the people who are working with the U.S. government. And the host said from CNN, you're kidding. Sometimes it's good to get into those non-political shows. And then CBS was taking the reports all through that 40 hours radio throughout the country. And I use this as an example from AP to Reuters to CNN that this is what I call trickle-up journalism. We can get the story out if we work together. If we build this independent media infrastructure in this country, it really can make a difference. And in the 2 minutes that I have remaining, I'm going to raise Timor. And I know that I've told many of you this story before. You've either heard it from Noam Chomsky or you've heard it from Pacifica Radio. But the reason that I'm raising it is because it unfortunately is relevant once again, and that is the brutality of the Indonesian military. Because of what happened on December 26th, the tsunami. Now that was a natural catastrophe. And by the way, the media did the right thing in that case. They raced to the area to tell us the stories of the people, and it proves once again that it doesn't matter if people are red, black, yellow, or white. If we see their faces, if we know their names, if we see the orphan kids or the women or men who are suffering, people all over the world care. It doesn't matter where they are. The outpouring of support was because the media spotlight was focused in the right place. But what they didn't show is the second tsunami that the people of this area in Indonesia have had to suffer through quite a long period of time. And that's the area, Aceh. If you said that word before December 26th, someone would probably say, God bless you. But afterwards, we learned about this area. 200,000 people died as a result of the tsunami. But more were killed after December 26 by the Indonesian military. And that has gone on for years. They've declared that whole area a state of siege. It's also where ExxonMobil has one of the largest gas fields operates in the world, and that's very much connected to the Indonesian military there, and a group of human rights groups and church groups have called for transparency, that it should be very clear who ExxonMobil is paying to protect its gas fields. I know well the brutality of the Indonesian military, having survived the massacre in Timor in 1991, when the Indonesian military moved in on defenseless protesters. You know the story of Timor, 1975, Kissinger and Ford give the go-ahead for the invasion. 90% of the weapons used were from the United States, this small country 300 miles above Australia, and they closed Timor to the outside world, and they carried out a slaughter, one of the great genocides of the 20th century. I got a chance to go there in 90 and 91. I was there with my colleague Alan Nairn. He was writing for The New Yorker. I was doing a documentary for Pacifica. And on November 12, 91, we were covering a procession of people honoring yet another young man who'd been killed by the military. We covered them marching from the church to the cemetery. When they got to the cemetery, there were thousands of them. We saw the Indonesian military march up. It was 8 o'clock in the morning. They were marching up on girls in their Catholic school uniforms, women in their traditional Timorese garb, boys in their school shorts. The people couldn't get away because there were walls on either side of the road. The soldiers marched up 12 to 15 abreast, carrying their USM-16s at the ready position. Alan and I walked to the front of the crowd. We knew they had committed many massacres in the past, but never in front of Western journalists. So we took out our equipment, though we'd always hidden it so as not to endanger Timorese talking to us. And I put on my headphones, held my microphone up like a flag. Alan put the camera above his head. We thought, if they saw Western journalists, maybe we could head off this attack. The soldiers marched up 12 to 15 abreast, carrying their USM-16s. They swept around the corner. Without warning, without hesitation, without provocation, they swept past us and they opened fire on the crowd, gunning people down from right to left. They beat us to the ground. Alan threw himself on top of me to protect me, and they took their USM-16s like baseball bats and they slammed them against his skull until they fractured it. They were killing everyone around us. They then put the guns to our heads, and they screamed two things, Australia and politique. Politique, because they were saying we were political to witness this, but that's our job as journalists, to go to where the silence is. And they were saying, screaming, Australia, Australia. They were demanding to know if we were from Australia. That's because 17 years before, when Indonesia invaded, there were 6 Australia-based journalists covering the invasion. They immediately executed 5 of them. The 6th, Roger East, was reporting from a radio station in Dili for the world. The Indonesian military dragged him out of the radio station. Radio is so important as a form of mass communication, the most important form of communication in the world. It's why in Haiti they ransack the radio stations if they play musique engagée, you know, political music. It is the place, the most accessible form of communication. So they drag Roger East out and he shouts, I'm from Australia, I'm from Australia. They shoot him into the harbor, December 8th, 75, the day after the invasion, with so many thousands of Timorese. The Australian government hardly protested. We believe because years later, Australia and Indonesia would sign the Timor Gap Treaty, dividing up Timor's oil between Australia and Indonesia. Oil is the source of so much pain in the world. And so on that day, November 12, 91, as we lay on the ground, Alan, covered in blood, the firing squad of soldiers with the guns at our heads, we shouted back, no, we're from America. They had stripped us now of everything. The only thing I had left was my passport. We kept shouting, America, America. They became convinced of this, and they pulled the guns from our heads. We believe because we were from the same country their weapons were from. They would have to pay a price for killing us that they had never had to pay for killing the Timorese. And they moved on. We got into a Red Cross Jeep. Dozens of Timorese jumped on top of us to escape this killing field, and we drove as a human mass to the hospital. When we got to the hospital, the doctors and nurses started to cry when they saw us. We believe because of two things, what we represent to the people of Timor, all of us, as Americans, and not just to the people of Timor, but to people all over the world. We represent the sword and the shield. The sword, because all too often the U.S. government provides regimes, repressive regimes, with weapons or uses them themselves, like in Iraq. But we as the American people also represent the shield. We come from the most powerful country on earth. Every little act we engage in has a ripple effect all over the world. And on that day, November 12, 91, they saw that shield bloodied, and it just deepened their despair. Alen, 10 years later, when the people of East Timor celebrated their freedom, May 20, 2002, we got into Timor, 100,000 Timorese gathered in the sandy plain outside Dili. It was an incredible moment. As the clock struck midnight, Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, gave his speech, and then Xanana Gusmão, the rebel leader of East Timor, got up, the founding president of East Timor, and he unfurled the flag of the Democratic Republic of East Timor. The people looked up, and there was this fireworks display, and you could see the light in their tear-stained faces. This nation of survivors had prevailed. They had resisted, and they had won at an unbelievably high price, a third of their population wiped out, a genocide proportionately worse than Cambodia, but they had won. And they thanked people all over the world. They knew they couldn't do it alone. Sure, they were the bravest. They were on the front lines. They bore the brunt of the pain. But they thanked people, especially in the most powerful countries, for demanding that their governments turn those weapons away, stop supporting human rights abusing regimes. And it is a lesson to all of us, whether we are journalists or politicians, whether we're librarians, students, professors, whether we are artists, shopkeepers, farmers, whether we are employed or unemployed. We have a decision to make every day, every hour of every day, and that is whether to represent the sword or the shield. Democracy Now.
Thank you, Amy. I'd like to thank all the panelists, Bernie Sanders, Naomi Klein, and Amy. Please join us tomorrow for more of our panelists. Thank you all very much for coming.